What are all these for? Just fill us in on that.
Well, I tend to wear this when I come to the cinema quite normally.
Is that loud enough?
Yeah.
Yeah, I tend to wear this when I come to the cinema. I'm a bit disappointed by it. This is my regimental attire, and I'm sorry to be sort of dressed in this today. But so our colours are this little breastplate here. In my regiment, some have a little flag that they carry with their war victories on it. In mine, every individual carries it, in theory, on their hearts. So everyone, no matter how junior, how senior, bears the history of the regiment. And then these are just various campaign medals. So for each country you go to where it's an operation, you get given a medal for being there.
So okay. And in terms of the different countries you've been to, you've been in the Army 17 years. You've moved around a fair bit around the world. Just give us a snapshot of the sort of things you've been doing in different countries.
Yeah, so I joined in 2000, just before the Twin Towers were hit. I finished my training, in fact, and we sort of went in to watch the Twin Towers falling, sort of new things were going to change. So my first tour was quite a normal one in Northern Ireland, working with the police service in Northern Ireland, and we were patrolling, tried to stop the IRA. This is before the sort of ceasefire really took place, trying to stop them mounting their attacks and finding them. And then straight after that, really switched to the Middle East, so Iraq after the war, but to try and stabilize the country. And you could argue maybe we weren't very successful. And 7 months there in the south of the country in support of the sort of US coalition, and then Afghanistan for a few months. And then to North Africa and Mali most recently, rebuilding their army after it was defeated and then mounted a coup and overthrew the government, and the country almost fell to Al-Qaeda. And the French went in with a warfighting mission and secured the country, and then they sent in a mission to try and rebuild the army, and I was one of the training teams to try and help, one of many, but one of the training teams to try and help do that. So that's broadly what I've been up to.
And you had some time with 16 Air Assault Brigade. Just tell us what they get up to.
They're a great, fun organization. I guess you'd normally associate them with the paratroopers, but a few outsiders like me sometimes get drafted in. So I was with them for 2 years. The brigade is basically moves by air, so whether by helicopter or by with Apaches in support or by fixed wing, and then they parachute in. So they're a force that can be deployed around the world, probably with the Americans. And the Americans have a phrase that they could deploy a division, which is probably about 6,000 people in anywhere in the world in one period of darkness. And we were sort of part of that division. So it's in effect, it's a deterrent to anyone who might be trying to attack the UK and our allies to say, we can reach you wherever you are. So we didn't actually go anywhere, but we were just held at readiness, ready to go if we needed to. But sometimes the fact of having them is enough to stop anything happening.
And this involved jumping out of planes and so on, so you did a bit of that, and night jumps, did you enjoy that kind of thing? What's a night jump like, parachuting?
Well, I shouldn't pretend to be a seasoned parachutist. I did enough to get qualified. And then meaning I could be ready to jump if I needed to. In truth, I don't think you really do very much to parachute. You're in a line. There are people who are loading you out the door, but the reality is if you hesitate, they will just throw you out the door. So you basically just need to be able to stand up and walk forwards and then take three steps. But they're probably the hardest three steps I've ever taken, and that you've got to remember it, left and then right, or is it right and left and then out the door? But then once you're out the door, then you sort of are falling, but not for too long. And then it's actually, once the parachute's open, it's very nice. Night, though, is you have your kit. When you jump out of the plane, you pull a cord and it falls below you. So you feel a weight hanging off your leg, which is about 5 meters or so. And so at night, you just know roughly how long you'll be in the air for. But if you can't see the ground, it's when you feel that weight stop, you know that you're about to hit the ground. And there's generally, I'm not an experienced parachutist. Those who are, just say there's real no skill to it. You just take what hits you. And so you just hold on and hit the ground. And that's it. I'm afraid to dispel any myths that might be about roles and things like that.
And what do you enjoy most about life in the Army? And what do you find the biggest challenge?
It's a great profession still. I think the British Army is still a respected organization and gets up to good things still and is a necessary force for good in the world. I think if you didn't have the British and Americans are our allies, then the world system would be very different. I know there are different views to that. But so it's generally a force for good, which I enjoy hugely. But I also enjoy it as a Christian. And the chance to live as a Christian amongst non-Christian people, and then to demonstrate the truth of the God whom I serve and living out lives amongst them. I suppose the hard things related to that, well, maybe two things that are hard. One is the mobility. You're based around the UK and you tend to move every 2 years, so your family sort of ups and moves every 2 years. It's tricky to stay in a church, therefore, because you're moving every so often, and then you might go overseas for a little while. So that instability is not hard. But from a Christian, I'd say it's keeping, I guess, like anywhere in any secular environment, it is keeping your godliness and saltiness while there, and keeping your distinctiveness, I find, the thing that challenges me probably most, really, about it all.
We're thinking today particularly of qualities like sacrifice and courage. Is courage something you come across much in your line of work? Then can you give us an example of the courage of soldiers?
Courage is probably the most esteemed attribute within my peer group, and every soldier would talk about courage as being the greatest thing. And it probably is of all the characteristics, you know, that wish to willingness to face personal danger for a common good, and not to worry that you might be throwing yourself into harm's way. And so it is a vital thing. We actually see two sides of it, though. We see sort of what we call physical courage, which is the bravery, the acts of bravery you might be familiar with. But then we also talk about moral courage, which is when you're living your everyday life, do you have courage to do what is right with those around you? And if you see someone else not, do you have the moral courage to actually say something? And it's been well said that rarely do we find someone who has moral courage in peacetime who won't have physical courage in war. The two sort of go side by side. Examples of courage, there are so many, and I suppose every time that someone thinks that they might get hurt, but yet they lay aside their personal interests and do it anyway. There was one of the first parachutists when they were trying out the idea, and these were pretty wild, brave people. They didn't have a proper system to parachute with, and so they used the door handle by the plane that they attached their static line to. So when they jumped out, that line would go taut and pull their parachute out. The commander came to it. He was about the third out, and he saw it was just hanging on by one screw at that point. In other words, if he jumped out and that screw had come out, then his parachute wouldn't have opened and he'd have just plummeted down. But he thought in a moment, but if I don't, then everyone will lose confidence in parachuting. So he jumped out the plane door, not quite knowing what was going to happen. And clearly he lived to recount the tale, and it did open. But that sort of, you know, is maybe that's foolishness, but there are examples of courage that you hear of regularly.
And Remembrance Sunday, what does remembrance mean to you in particular as a soldier? Presumably you've got people you know who have been killed in action.
It's such an important time because it does kind of remind you of those who have gone before. I think we have a big tradition of history in the British Army that you stand on the shoulders of others who have gone before. And remembrance gives you a chance professionally just to remember that. On a personal level, it's a good chance to, I think we're duty bound. We've got to keep doing it as soldiers, because there are so many people who have died in this generation, as well as the past, whose families are still around. And I think to our own service people, if we forget the dead quickly, it has a huge effect on their confidence, saying, well, if I do that, will my family be looked after? So remembering individuals and their families who have died is really important. And as a Christian, I also do remember it with gratitude, because I sort of consider back to the wars particularly and just think of what God did and how he worked. And I'm grateful for a chance just to reflect on that and be thankful for sort of what's gone before and how God has delivered us before.
Just tell us your story of how you came to faith in Christ yourself. So you weren't born in a Christian home. Just tell us a bit about your upbringing and what you believed or didn't believe growing up.
Yeah, so I neither wanted to be a soldier nor a Christian. I was born in a very normal sort of British family, raised in London, actually. But I had absolute, complete disinterest to the things of God. And I did have to go to church quite regularly, but I just didn't believe it for one moment. And I had no interest in finding out about it either, to my discredit. And I don't mean that to speak against my parents, because actually I don't think if my parents had introduced me to Christ, I would have been interested in it at all. So it was more me than them. But while I was at school, I did go to a boarding school, and there were 10 of us in my year there. And at one point, I think there were 8 going to the Christian meeting that someone ran in their front room. 8 of 10 from my year went to it, and they invited me along. And I simply went because they offered free biscuits and orange squash. And I thought that would be really nice to get some free foods and something interesting. But something caused me to stay. Many of them stopped going, and I stayed at the meeting. Having known nothing about Christ, it was his manner of life and character that suddenly just opened my eyes to the reality and the truth of Christ. I took a tentative step in my second year when someone gave a gospel invitation saying, if you believe on Christ, which I did, then you can pray this prayer after me. And that was a real vital step for me in coming to Christ. But looking back now, I don't see that there was a great change in my life. From that point, I would have called myself a Christian. I carried on going and I believed it. I guess I was still young. But what I saw is the Lord's graciousness and tenderness with me. As I went away for a year to Malaysia after school before university with a Christian friend and one other guy who wasn't a Christian, but became one out there. And we were teaching English at a Bible college in Malaysia. And there was an opportunity for once to really live as a Christian. We were sometimes kind of without food and money, and we were literally having to seek God and pray about what our next meal would be. That really was a point at which I say I turned from my own ways and followed Christ. The reason I say the tenderness of God is I think if I would have turned myself away many times if I was him, but I know that he received me. And from that point on, I went to university as a real Christian. But I think that second year at school was actually really important nonetheless in their sort of journey there. So the Lord received me.
Just a final question. You're holding a book that you've been involved in compiling, putting together. Just tell us a bit about it. So it's called The Fight of the Faith.
Yes, sure. So Brigadier Ian Dolby may have mentioned it if you were at his talk on Wednesday. He wrote the foreword and he helped hugely with it. But a friend and I, over the years, had read a number of short biographies of Christians in the armed forces, and they were scattered around different books. With the decline of prominent Christianity in this country, we were sort of provoked to think, well, it's slightly ignorance in knowing what Christians have done before in the armed forces. And we found these wonderful accounts of sort of bravery, but of faith alongside it, and godly men and women, actually on both sides, there's a German sailor who's in here as well, featured, who is a real Christian, who was shot up by the RAF, but cried to God from the sea and was rescued incredibly. So we wanted to compile it into one book. We did it for charity, so we didn't write any of it. We approached authors like Faith Cook and Brigadier Ian Dolby, who gave us sometimes existing chapters, other times they wrote new chapters. So it's 12 short biographies of Christians in the armed forces.
And any favourites? What one would you pick out?
Yeah, so I General Havelock, who was known as the Christian General. I read his biography just before I joined the army and was struck by one of his habits, which was to take a Bible with him wherever he went, and a hymn book. And in fact, this morning, as I was leaving home, I had a hymn book on the side. I was just about to leave home thinking I won't take it. And I suddenly thought, remember Havelock. And so I stuck with me that march over the 17 years. And there's a lovely statue of him as well in Trafalgar Square, the Christian General. You know, what an influence a godly man had. So it's hard to say, but in terms of effect on me, I think that one has been the one that struck with me the most.
Philip has brought a few copies of this with him, so if you want a Christmas present for someone else or for yourself, otherwise do get it online. It's called The Fight of Faith. Thank you very much. Philip's going to speak to us in a few moments. First, we're going to stand and sing together again.
Well, thank you very much for that reading, and I'm going to be speaking just to reassure you, not on the whole of that reading, but on verse 9, which is where I'd like to focus this morning. And let me just read that once again. But we see him who for a little while was made lower than the angels, namely Jesus, crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. Well, it's really lovely to be with you here this morning. I come from a small church in North London, so I've heard of this church over the years, and it's really lovely to be here this morning. But actually, it's my chief pleasure to be able to just this morning maybe bring a simple message reflecting on remembrance, but reflecting on the remembrance of Christ and of his death. And maybe this is some things that you know before. Maybe I can reassure you, encourage you in the truth of the gospel. Or maybe you're like I was a few years ago, of not yet knowing much about Christ and who he is. And I hope something that I may say this morning would be of help to you. It's also a very poignant time to be speaking, to think that it is actually the 100th anniversary of the armistice today. That day on the 11th hour, on the 11th day of the 11th month, i.e. the 11th of November at 11 o'clock, in 1918, that the armistice was signed and that the ceasefire took place to end the First World War. And what a war that really was, and how thankful we should be that it's finished. But I remember the Kohima epitaph that then followed. They were known as the Forgotten Army in Northeast India, because they felt that everyone's focus was on Europe, and that's where everyone thought about, and they forgot about all the fighting going on in India. And they wrote that famous epitaph as a result: when you go home, tell them of us and say, for your tomorrow we gave our today. And regardless of our opinions of the rights or wrongs of war, and there has always been a variety of views, and I don't mean to offend anyone who doesn't think that a Christian should be stood here in uniform, but we see the sacrifice of so many around us for us to bring the freedom that we have today. But what I'd like to focus in on, and which is why I find remembrance so helpful, is looking back equally at a sacrifice on our behalf made 2,000 years ago, 2,018 years ago, by the Lord Jesus Christ on the cross, which this verse speaks of, where it says, Jesus crowned with glory and honor, that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. And a really astonishing verse and simple summary of the gospel. And I'd just like to pull out three things about this from this verse. The first, it was God's deliberate plan that Christ should die. Secondly, that it was absolutely essential. There was no other way. And thirdly, that it was victorious. And I hope you'll see the parallels with our remembrance of the wars that go along here. And so that have gone before. And so the first thing was how deliberate and purposeful it was. It's been well said about countries that they will never go to war unless it is absolutely essential. The sheer cost in human life, and then the cost of the actual financial cost of it, means that they won't commit to war unless it is absolutely vital, that the national security or the very national survival is threatened, leading you to do something that you should never have to do, which is turn to violence. And this is where we come to with this verse, which talks about Jesus. It says, so that by the grace of God, he might taste death for everyone. And that's what I want to say to start off with, that Christ's death was by the grace of God. It was a deliberate and it was a purposeful act. Many times when the Bible talks about this being by the grace of God, that is, by the decision and goodness and the will of God, it talks about Christ's death and says, in many times, according to the scriptures, according to the scriptures. In other words, all that happened to Christ leading to his crucifixion was according to what God had foreordained and even written in a book contained in the scriptures, in the Bible and the Old Testament. Even when Christ was about to be arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane And Peter drew a sword, you remember the incident, to defend him. And the Lord's response is that he could ask his father, pray to his father now, and he'd send him 12 legions of angels. We can see that actually Christ submitted himself by the grace of God that he might taste death for every man. And that's the first thing that comes out from this verse here. Christ's death was by the grace of God. And I'll come on to that in a moment more about why that's potentially so striking. The second reason is that it was absolutely essential. It's maybe stating the obvious, but there was no other way. It was absolutely vital that it took place. And soldiers over the years have taken some solace in that fact. When they've seen their friends die or they realise that they may need to, they take solace in the fact that it's necessary. It's worthwhile. This is a cause to which I should lay down my life. As I read the Kehime epitaph, for their tomorrow we gave our today. In other words, it's worth what we're doing. Not only worth it, it's essential. It is the only way. And this is the second thing that I would like to pull out from this verse. It was a deliberate act of God according to his purposes. But it was essential in that he says that he might taste death for everyone. Every single person's death was tasted by Christ. You might say, well, why did Christ die? He was there not fighting in a glorious battle. He wasn't leading a charge into Rome or in Jerusalem to overthrow the Romans. He was crucified, hanging on a cross in between two convicted criminals who were being executed for their crime. He was, it were, what we might say in modern language, was on death row, being executed as a criminal. And yet it says that he was being executed, that he was dying for everyone, for every man Christ was tasting death for. And this is where I come to about how essential it was. And I think there are Christian or non-Christian alike, a really important point to draw out from here. You see, the Bible teaches that the wages of sin is death. That is, that when we sin against God, there is a punishment which God will bring against that act, which the Bible describes as death. Now, not only a matter of us growing old and descending to the grave, but actually the Bible talks about what happens after the death, at the resurrection. That is what the Bible calls the Day of Judgment, when we'll appear before him. And I'm not saying this in order to be heavy or in some ways to shake us wrongly, but simply to be factual and to describe the reality of what is going on there. The reality, we could say, of the word, which many don't like to, of the judgment and then of heaven and of hell. That's the death that drove Christ to the cross, and the death which was coming to every one of us. You see why I say that it was essential. See, there was no discretionary or no innocent person, but every person left to themselves was heading like a runaway train to their death when they appear before God. Nothing could be more essential than Christ tasting death for them, for us. I read just recently the biography again of Eric Liddell, who, although he wasn't a soldier himself, he was a missionary in China during the Second World War. Eric Liddell was the one from the film Chariots of Fire, who won Olympic glory, but was famous for, you may know, but for not running on a Sunday. And so the event in the Olympics that he was most favoured to win, he declined to enter it because the final was going to be on a Sunday. But he entered two others and he won a gold medal at the Olympics. And it's a great testament. The film Chariots of Fire covers him. But after doing that, he became a missionary and he went out to China and was then, during the war, was interned by the Japanese in a prisoner of war camp. While he was there, he was famous and people knew about him. And a prisoner exchange was arranged, which included Eric Liddell, to be able to go back home to his family. And I think he even had a little girl who he had never met, a daughter whom he had not met before. But he declined the prisoner exchange. And the reason was that he was a Christian, and he knew that he had. His eternity was fixed. He was at peace with God. And so someone else went in his place. And Eric Little died of sickness in that Japanese internment camp and never returned home again. But that was him. He willingly laid down his life so that someone else could go. And that's just a great illustration, I think, of why Christ died for every one of us. Left to ourselves, we're guilty before God. And though we might get away with things in this life, and you may hear of some scandalous people who do some things and they get away with it, it seems, but actually after death comes a judgment. And that's where we were all heading. And the only way we could be saved was not because none of us were guilty, but by Christ dying on our behalf. And this is the wonderful news described in this verse, the absolute essential nature of it. Christ had to die that he might taste death for everyone. No exception. There on the cross, Christ was dying for our sin. For every one of us was the reason why Christ died, that we might live. Wonderful truth. There's a lovely hymn writer who wrote that hymn. Here is love, vast as the ocean, loving kindness as the flood. And the refrain is, who is this love shall not remember? Who can cease to sing his praise? It shall never be forgotten throughout heaven's eternal days. And this morning, as we remember the 100th year of the First World War, it's right we should remember that. But also, how much we should remember Christ's death once for all upon the cross to bring us to God. What love that was. He was mocked, wasn't he? He was ridiculed on the cross. But the reason why he didn't resist was because of his great love wherewith he loved us. He wanted to bear our sin upon the cross. He was executed as a criminal in our place. Well, the third reason, and very briefly, why, before I make a few points of application, for why this is such an event to remember is, thirdly, it was victorious. Wouldn't it be so bitter if this morning we were remembering conflicts, whatever it may be, a loss of life, which actually appeared vain in the end, which was not successful, which did not achieve what was expected. It does sometimes happen where the best plans of men and mice don't come into being, and people lay down their life and it proves they are defeated, or it was simply a wrong objective they were trying to achieve. But there's none of that with Christ in this verse. Did you notice the curious way that the verse describes it? That by the grace of God, he might taste death for everyone. Do you see that word, taste? He might taste death for everyone. That is, we can understand, I suppose, what it means in our modern language, to put it in his mouth and taste it, and do no more than that. And this alludes to the fact that Christ is no longer dead. He did not die and then remain dead in the grave. We're not remembering that tragedy of Christ dying, the just as a just man for the unjust, and thinking, well, how vain, in that he is still dead. He is buried in Jerusalem, and we can go and see his tomb, and doubtless millions of people would. But no, we cannot do that. There is an empty tomb that might be where he was, but it's empty because Christ came down from heaven as the Son of God, the eternal being. For a time, he became a man for that reason that I've described, that he might die for us. But having died 3 days later, or on the third day, I should say, he rose from the dead and his body was no longer to be found. And then he appeared to many hundreds at a time. And that's why I think this verse says that he, by the grace of God, might taste death for everyone. He did die. And I'm not meaning to suggest, as some have said over the years, well, maybe he passed out and was unconscious for a little while. And then he came to in the tomb and sort of rolled the stone out of the way, and then his disciples hid him. No, he did die. His last tremendous words, or some of his last tremendous words, were, "It is finished." And then it says he breathed his last and gave up the ghost, saying, "Father, into thy hands I commit my spirit." He did die. But the wonderful truth is, he then rose again on that third day after his death, which of course we now celebrate on Easter Sunday, and that wonderful day where Christ rose from the dead. And what do we take from that? If I could put a military hat on for 1 second, then I might say, doesn't it show that he was victorious? That it was a victorious death, that the purpose for which he went and died was achieved, evidenced by his resurrection. And may I say this to encourage us this morning about the absolute truth of the Lord Jesus Christ. When Christ was questioned by many and they asked him many questions, he said that famous statement in John's Gospel, that I am the way, the truth and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. The absolute truth of Christ, that we won't find truth concerning eternal things anywhere other than in the Lord Jesus Christ. But we should not despair in that and think, well, how close-minded, or am I right to believe that? The resurrection demonstrates that it is one whom we should indeed believe in. His death was victorious. There are some of the war memorials around the country sometimes carry that little engraving, the glorious dead. Glorious in that they succeeded and they were glorious. And we could say that of Christ, his victorious death, that the grave could not contain him. His Father would not allow his body to see one jot of decomposition. But on that very, very early in the morning, on the third day, having rested on the Sabbath, on the first day of the week, he rose from the dead and ever lives now. And this really is the subject of the book of Hebrews, which I do not have time clearly to go into now. So I'll say a few things by way of conclusion. But a death that was deliberate, ordained of God, that by the grace of God, he did not desire anyone to be sent to eternity apart from him in hell, but he wanted all to live. So he sent his Son as in the form of a sinful man to die for us, that we might be forgiven for our sin. And he died for every one of us. And not only did he die, he only tasted death. He was victorious and rose again. Well, may I say a couple of things by way of conclusion? The first is, I trust that we will be encouraged by the truth of Christ and by what God has provided. We could never do enough to work our way up to heaven and earn our place before God on that day of judgment. There's no one, not one, who could ever stand before God and say, "Lord, I have kept your law perfectly inwardly and outwardly." But God, by the grace of God, Christ descended and came as a man and then was hung upon a cross by the will of God, by the goodness of God. The second thing I'd like to say is I trust that we believe that to be true about ourselves too. The scripture is pretty comprehensive in what it says, that he might taste death for everyone. And some of us may, and I certainly thought of this before I was a Christian, well, I'm not that bad. I'm okay. I don't need God. Well, this verse answers that by saying, but Christ had to die for us, for every one of us. In other words, each of us had that judgment and death coming, but Christ had to die for each of us. So you're saying it's not necessary, but yet Christ had to go to the cross to die for every one of us. Maybe that could throw some light on our own hearts and of our own needs, that we might realize the wondrous provision that God has done. Well, this is why this morning I wanted to speak not on the millions that have gone before and offered their lives in the wars that have taken place around the globe, but of one man, the Lord Jesus Christ, whose love surpasses all human love, whose death upon the cross was plan of God, was essential, and was victorious. And unlike the sacrifices of the world wars, it does demand a response. We're not now automatically right with God, but he calls us, having made provision for us now to turn again to him, knowing that he is a God of love who has sent that most precious thing, his son, to die upon the cross for us, that we might live. Well, may I finish by reading the last bit of the verse again. Because of the suffering of death, so that by the grace of God, he might taste death for everyone.